I bet you didn't know that the teaching of Latin in schools is making a comeback. Latin? Really? Isn't that a dead language? Well, take a look at what studies say about how well Latin students do on a test like the SAT. Memoria Press's Latin program will revolutionize your students' vocabulary, knowledge, and their understanding of grammar. And there is no better subject for teaching critical thinking skills. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday, April the 25th, we're going to be talking about a Supreme Court church-state case involving a Lutheran school. It is not unusual to find the church in court. This has to do with the state of Missouri and state funds going to, well, a playground. We'll find out about the case and how it was argued and some of the questions that the justices posed to those arguing on either side. Joining us, David Kortman, Senior Legal Counsel and Vice President for U.S. Litigation for Alliance Defending Freedom, and he is the one who presented oral arguments before the Supreme Court last week. David, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Our listeners are probably curious what it is like to present oral arguments at the Supreme Court. How would you describe it?
It's great fun. I mean, it's obviously the pinnacle of an attorney's career to present arguments at the Supreme Court. You're going up against what's arguably nine of the greatest legal minds in the country. So it's really a great experience, and you get up there and kind of go through the issues and see what the justices are thinking and hopefully persuade them of your cause.
So what is the crux of Trinity Lutheran versus Comer?
I mean, it's about obviously getting funding for a religious organization to fix up their playground, but there's a much bigger principle here, and that is if the government sets out all these different benefit programs, and of course the government is involved in all areas of our lives these days, the question is can it say once we set up this neutral program that simply because a person or an organization is faith-based that they could exclude them from that program simply because of their religious status? And that's really the big principle at stake here.
So what was the essence of your argument then?
The mainstay of our argument was it violates the protection of the Constitution, specifically the Free Exercise Clause, to basically say that we're going to single out people of faith or religious organizations and discriminate against them, and not only not treat them equally to everybody else, but actually treat them worse. And there's no justification for doing so.
How would you summarize your opponent's arguments there during oral arguments?
I mean, they basically, you people have heard of the so-called separation of church and state, and they basically said, look, it violates this principle, the Establishment Clause, to give money for the government to give money to a church. But first of all, it's wrong in its context. It's such a broad principle. It's not right in the application. It's not right historically. And they try to stay with this kind of lofty principle that when you kind of bring it down, really falls apart. So that was their main argument throughout the case.
Of course, in oral arguments, the justices ask questions of attorneys for both sides. What questions from the justices stood out the most to you?
Well, I think the most beneficial to our side was there were justices across ideological lines. So a lot of people ahead of time were always trying to predict what the outcome is going to be. And they were saying, well, gee, maybe this is a 4-4 split before Justice Gorsuch came on, and maybe it's 5-4 for the church. But we never thought that. And what proved to be true was justices both on the ideological left, if you will, and ideological right, we're all concerned about the state's argument that you could just discriminate against religious organizations just because they're religious, even though they satisfied all the neutral criteria that the state set up for the program, and even though they were graded higher than almost everybody else under this program, that solely because they were religious, they got booted out of the program, and the majority of justices seemed to have a problem with that.
Were there any questions from justices that seemed to kind of more favor your opposition?
Sure. I mean, you always get questions from both sides of the aisle, and you try to predict what's going to happen. But obviously, the more you do that, the less you really know. But yeah, there were a lot of questions about how far does the principal go, and what are they allowed to do with the money, and can there be constraints on them? And so there's always questions about, you know, testing what your principle is and how would that apply to hypotheticals. If anybody follows the court, they're infamous for a test hypothetical. So they can come up with whatever questions they want to, and you've got to be able to apply your principle to their hypothetical. So it's always challenging to know where they're going with each of those questions.
I take it it's traditional for brand new justices to remain silent for some time, but were there any questions from the newly minted Justice Gorsuch?
Well, there were, and I actually didn't receive any from Justice Gorsuch, but the other side received a couple. But what's interesting is I actually sat through the arguments on Monday and Tuesday of the week, and ours was on Wednesday, and Justice Gorsuch was very engaged. He asked excellent questions. He had a good sense of humor. He seemed pretty comfortable. So he's already becoming involved in the process and seems to be right at home already, even though it's early in his career at the court.
So what is the outcome of Trinity versus Comer going to mean one way or the other? If the court decides in your favor, what will that mean? And if they find against Trinity Lutheran, what will that mean?
Well, I think if they find in Trinity's favor, which we're certainly hopeful that they will, all indications look like they will, then I think they set out a principle that's already enshrined in the Constitution, and that is you can't treat religious people or religious organizations worse than anybody else. There's no justification for doing so. And conversely, if they rule on behalf of the state, it seems to me a very dangerous precedent, not only for people of faith, for other people, for the government to say, based on your status, that we're going to treat you worse than everybody else, even though you otherwise satisfy the criteria of the program. So imagine, for example, not being able to send the police and fire out to the playground or out to the school if there's a fire, if there's a burglary, or not being able to have religious people receive government benefits just like everybody else does. I mean, that's a dangerous precedent. So it seems to me if the state comes out ahead, there's really should be great concern.
During oral arguments, James Layton, representing the state of Missouri, stated almost 200 years ago, the people of the state of Missouri adopting language used by the founding fathers, decided that we were not going to tax people in order to give money to churches. What's your response to that statement?
Yeah, I mean, it's wrong and taken out of context. And so there's a couple problems with it. Number one, historically speaking, at the founding of the country, where they were talking about funding was funding going preferentially to churches to build churches. And so they were taxing people, and Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance discusses it, but basically they were taxing people to say, okay, what church do you want your money going to? So it wasn't this neutral government program. In fact, these type of programs didn't exist until the 1900s, where the government welfare system kicked into place and the government began putting its fingers involved in everyone's business. So back in history, it was these preferential treatments to build churches of the preferred religion of that particular state. Well, of course, we don't have anything like that these days. There's no neutral government program back then. So imagine taking those facts where there's this preferential building of churches for whatever the preferred religion of that day and trying to apply it now to say that we won't even treat you the same as everybody else solely because you're a church or religious organization. I just think it flips the concept on its head, and it's not accurate, historically speaking.
There was a very interesting question posed by one of the justices that I read about having to do with tours at the state capitol there in Columbia, right, Missouri, where he essentially said you have someone, a full-time employee, who's going to be coordinating these tours with all kinds of school groups. Are you going to say that religious school kids can't come to the capitol and get a tour because they happen to attend a religious school? What does that kind of question point out to you?
Yeah, I mean, it just shows how far the state's argument goes, because under their argument and under the provision of the state constitution, it says no benefits directly or indirectly. So that example shows an indirect government benefit, just like police and fire, just like, for example, states have programs where they were removing asbestos in the ceilings of old buildings or lead in the paint. And imagine them saying, well, we're going to do all buildings, except we're not going to let the religiously run preschool get involved in that, or the playground here. We're going to make all kids safe except for those kids who choose to play on the playground of Trinity. I mean, it absolutely makes no sense, and it shows where their argument breaks down.
Justice Ginsburg cited a 1947 church-state case. What can you tell us about it? And does this ruling apply to Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia v. Missouri?
Yeah, it's interesting because that was one of the first questions. And of course, I'm familiar with the case. It's called the Everson case. And there's a line in there similar to what you just mentioned about, you know, funding churches. The problem is several. Number one, the same case also said that we have to be careful in trying not to establish a state church, that we exclude religious organizations from general and neutral government benefits. So that very case that she cited actually helps our side of the argument. The case also dealt with whether you can include busing. So if municipalities say we're going to allow busing to private schools, can we also allow that busing to go to religious schools? And the court said, yes, you can, that it didn't violate the Constitution to include religious schools in these neutral programs. So interestingly, she cited one quote from the case, but the case overall supports the Trinity's argument.
In advance of oral arguments, Lambda Legal and LGBT rights advocacy firm, they issued a brief against the decision in favor of Trinity Lutheran. They said it would lead to discrimination against LGBT folks and that some churches, quote, don't wish to serve everybody, and that Trinity Lutheran government funds will then be used to provide social services on a discriminatory basis. What's your response?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the scare tactic from the left. First of all, those issues have nothing to do with the case at all. They're completely from left field. You know, the other thing is the question is you know, almost all private organizations decide who their membership is, decide who their leadership is. It's not discrimination. It's religious autonomy. It's the ability of a private group to form around like-minded individuals. So it's a complete red herring, had nothing to do with the case. And then the question is, for example, if we have an evangelical church, are we going to require that they allow someone who's Muslim or Jewish to operate or lead the church? I mean, it's just a silly argument that I think just tries to push their agenda.
Finally, then, with about 30 seconds, what's the lesson in church-state relations that we should learn from this case, Trinity v. Comer?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest principle is you don't treat religious people or religious organizations worse than everybody else just because they're religious. And especially when they're actually practicing, you know, not only constitutional rights to free exercise and free speech and free association, so you have all these constitutional rights, do we punish them simply because they're choosing to exercise these rights? And the answer is no. The Constitution says no, and hopefully the court will say no.
David Kortman is Senior Counsel and Vice President for U.S. Litigation for Alliance Defending Freedom. He presented oral arguments before the Supreme Court last week. You'll find a link to Alliance Defending Freedom at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. David, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., it's our weekly media coverage of religion segment with Terry Mattingly. This is the kind of rough and tumble that we find when a church lives in a representative democracy, republic, where the church lives in that tension. Theologically, for us, we know that we are not of this world, and yet living in this world, we're citizens here too. And even as a church, we have rights as citizens and as organizations. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper every service every Sunday, preaching Christ crucified and risen, our hope for years to come. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is. 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri. Find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.